Well, I think we'll go ahead and get started. I'm Ginny Bouvier, and I'm Senior Program Officer here at the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program. On behalf of the Institute, I'd like to welcome you all today for what is rather unique in the history of our Senior Fellow Project Reports, namely a kind of joint memoir and presentation from two individuals who, in their respective capacities as USSR Deputy Foreign Minister and U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs, were intimately involved in a dialogue about human rights that became pivotal in tipping the balance of power in the internal debate in the Soviet Union in favor of those who wanted to end the Soviet Union's totalitarian system, in transforming relations between the USSR and the USA, and in ending the Cold War. Ambassador Anatoly Adamyshyn served in the Soviet Foreign Ministry since 1957 and was head of the European Department in 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev became Secretary General of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and thus de facto head of government. In 1986, he was promoted to serve as one of the deputy foreign ministers with primary responsibility for Africa, and soon thereafter, Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze assigned him also to be the lead for the USSR human rights dialogue with the United States, a dialogue that would last more than 3 years. In 1992 to 94, he was the first Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Russian Federation and was intimately involved in the talks that led to a peace agreement ending Tajikistan's civil war in 1997. In the late 1990s, he was the Russian Minister for Cooperation with the Commonwealth of Independent States countries, and he served as ambassador to the United Kingdom and to Italy. Ambassador Adamyshyn received his PhD in history from the Diplomatic Academy of the USSR and graduated with honors in economics from the University of Moscow. We are pleased to have had him with us for this fellowship year. Working in close collaboration with Ambassador Adamyshyn this past year as a guest scholar at USIP, and from 1986 to 1990 as the U.S. lead and counterpart during the USSR-U.S. human rights dialogues, was Ambassador Richard Schifter to my right. Ambassador Schifter is an expert in the evolution of human rights in international relations since the end of World War II and the application of international human rights standards. He served in several senior foreign policy positions in the U.S. government from 1981 to 2001. He was also U.S. representative in the U.N. Human Rights Commission, Deputy U.S. Representative with the rank of Ambassador in the U.N. Security Council, Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs, Assistant to the President and Counselor of the National Security Council, and Special Advisor to the Secretary of State. He's a graduate of the College of the City of New York and Yale Law School. We're grateful for his participation in this project and his willingness to be with us this morning. The work of Ambassadors Adamyshyn and Schifter contribute to USIP's work in several key areas, especially in terms of our work on the Cold War, on human rights and conflict resolution, on negotiating behavior, and on intractable conflicts. In this regard, I would signal just a few USIP press-published books in these areas, namely Kenneth Jensen's Origins of the Cold War, a forthcoming volume edited by Julie Mertis and Jeff Helsing entitled Human Rights and Conflict, Exploring the Link Between Rights, Laws, and Peacebuilding, and Deborah Leong Fenton's book, Implementing U.S. Human Rights Policy, to which Ambassador Schifter was a contributor. Before turning over the podium, I'd like to also say a word of thanks to those who helped organize this event, especially Peter Wojciechowski, who is a PhD candidate in Government and Politics at the University of Maryland at College Park. Finally, I'd ask that you please turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices. They will interfere with the taping. We are taping the conversation today, recording it live, and it will be available from the USIP website later this week. I think we've discussed the order of the speakers, and we'll start with Anatoly Adamyshyn.
Thank you very much, Dini. Ambassador Richard Schifter and I jointly represent more than 150 years of professional and human experience. Hopefully, wise experience. But we still have enough energy to step far beyond the limits of our project title, which is United States-Soviet Humanitarian Dialogue 86-90. As a main conclusion, I would say that in those years, Dick and I did a pretty good job. Otherwise, why should we write a book about it? Speaking more seriously, I would like to highlight the following points. First, for a number of decades, the notion of human rights was perceived in the official Soviet Union as a cunning bourgeois invention intended to weaken socialism in its struggle with capitalism. This letter was hard to die, even though, according to the inexorable laws of history, it should have died a long time ago. Whenever Foreign Minister Gromyko, who held this post for 28 years, and I served under his command for most of that time, whenever he touched upon the subject of human rights, he would instruct us to firmly rebuff the West, primarily the United States. It was believed that the human rights which deserved attention were those in the social sphere: employment, education, health care, stable and secure living, which gives confidence in tomorrow's day, and so on. In that field, the Soviet Union could be proud of certain achievements. There was a time when social and ethnic equality were not empty words for us. The rights raised by the West, those that might be called political, were invariably put in inverted commas and with the addition so-called. There had been no humanitarian dialogue between the USSR and the United States whatsoever, for one cannot call mutual reproaches and accusations a dialogue. We were getting accused of not fulfilling the obligations which the USSR had taken by signing virtually all the fundamental documents concerning human rights. We would usually respond that those obligations were not legally binding. Or, if such an argument couldn't be pulled out, we would claim that the Soviet socialist law was, by its nature, more progressive than the bourgeois law. Therefore, it had a priority over the latter. A typical example of this kind was the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. If you remember, the struggle there was as follows. The USSR wanted to solidify Europe's post-war territorial and political arrangements, and in exchange for that, the West demanded concessions on humanitarian issues. Soviet leaders believed that we could accept those sections of the final act which served our interest, but would not fulfill humanitarian attachments. Despite the fact that this document, the final act, had been signed by the supreme leaders of 35 states, Leonid Brezhnev, on behalf of the USSR. At the same time, and I would like to emphasize this especially, there was also another approach inside the Soviet establishment. It maintained that so-called concessions were not a price that we would be paying to West, but that they met first of all our own needs. The existing system was in great need of reforms, and if foreign policy could facilitate them, it would give a double gain, so to say. There were very few those children of the 20th Congress of the Communist Party, as they were called, referring to Nikita Khrushchev's speech with denunciations of Stalin, but they tried really hard to change the system from the inside. All my previous background unconditionally brought me to their camp. Subsequently, we put a lot of effort into maintaining the all-European process because it provided opportunities not only for our foreign policy, but for a more reasonable domestic one as well. the time came, and in 1988 we worked jointly with Dick to ensure the success of All-European meeting in Vienna. This is the episode which Ginny has chosen for the written handout. Second, as Mikhail Gorbachev came to power, he initially thought that it would be enough just to patch some holes. Very soon, however, he realized that that USSR required radical reforming. It was necessary to start virtually from zero in creating a state governed by law. These reforms gave a new dimension to the United States-Soviet dialogue as well. The dialogue dealt with the following main themes. Dick and I described them in detail and almost always in the same tune. The issue put in the first place by the USA was Jewish emigration. By the end of the period we are covering, that was practically resolved, including such problematic sites as the famous Otkazniks, those who had been refused permission to leave on account of secrecy concerns. The approach that I and my comrades proposed to the superior leadership consisted in developing a law on entry and exit from the USSR for all citizens, irrespective of their ethnicity. With many difficulties and delays due to resistance from conservative circles, this law was finally issued. It took place for the first time in the history of our country. Since that time and until now, freedom to leave the country is an acting norm, and cases of its denial are strictly regulated by the law. Perhaps the most shameful matter of all was abuse of psychiatry. It was ended up with during the perestroika years as well. A useful contribution was made by the visit of United States psychiatrists to Moscow, who, in a totally unprecedented way for those times, were shown to local psychiatry asylums, including the so-called restricted, essentially prison-like institution, where they could examine patients at their own choice. An initiative to bring in such a delegation, modestly on my suggestion, came from Foreign Minister Shevardnadze, thus breaking the conservative resistance. Dick organized this work on the United States side. In this domain, we also managed to establish the rule of law principle, including significantly widened rights of patients. Unfortunately, it seems that nowadays there are attempts to revise this law. Number three on the United States-Soviet agenda was the issue of political prisoners. By that time, it was no longer such a mass scale phenomenon as it had been in the 20s through 50s, when 52 million political sentences had been given. This issue became closed by late 1988, when Gorbachev was able to declare in his historic speech at the United Nations General Assembly that there were no longer any people in the USSR who would be incarcerated for their political views or religious convictions. Amendments were made to the Criminal Code of the Russian Federation and of other republics of the Soviet Union, which nullified the infamous articles that had established penalties for anti-Soviet activities or propaganda. Those changes are still in vigor. A dispute, though, is in progress in my country whether there are political prisoners in today's Russia. At any rate, there are solitary cases like this one of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former owner of Yukos. And in regard to religion, the law on the freedom of conscience was developed and passed, and it was quite adequate to international standards. Now, as many observers point out, there is a certain misbalance between the Orthodox religion and some others. Lawmaking also entered the spheres which were not mentioned by the American side at that time, such as freedom of press, freedom of association, freedom of marches, etc. Here, too, appropriate laws were drafted and passed. In today's Russia, those are problematic areas. Steps from Gorbachev's glasnost have been made backwards rather forwards. Our joint work with DIC also covered a number of other aspects of humanitarian cooperation, and it is important to recall that the gains were not made for one side only. For example, the problem of Nazi criminals' extradition was addressed exclusively in the interest of the Soviet side. Third, the decisive factor in all of that was the firm desire of Gorbachev and his team to rebuild the country on the foundations of justice and law. The Soviet-American cooperation was important, but its impact was not definitive. It did contribute to solve our interior problems, primarily by focusing on really important ones. And it was really important because we in the foreign ministry sometimes didn't know about the problems existing in our own country. And I remember that when Dick came one of the first times to me and he mentioned Perm 36, I wondered what it was, but it was one of the famous lager of the Gulag system. So it was Dick who focused on this problem, and we then had more information in order to try to settle it. And by the way, Dick kept playing this role here in Washington as well, because he told me, read this book, read this other book, please cover this topic. And I really, a lot of topics in my part of the book are covered by Dick's suggestion. Fourth, the United States-Soviet humanitarian dialogue yielded fruits beyond its own domain. It helped placing the theme of human rights on the same level of importance as the issues of arms race containment. Movement along these two tracks helped to make progress on each of them. When speaking at the Politburo meeting in December 1988, Shevardnadze emphasized that there were three main themes in our relations with the United States: disarmament, Afghanistan, and human rights. We touched upon all three of them in our book. Fifth, Dick and I have been very lucky to have such bosses, Shevardnadze and Gorbachev for myself, and Schulz and Reagan for Dick. Those American leaders were able to realize, I dare to say it, and I suppose not without Dick's help, that Gorbachev had started a matter of great importance, not just for the USSR, but also for the United States and, in fact, for the rest of the world. I would say that in the final years of Reagan's presidency, the United States rendered assistance to Gorbachev in implementing his grand project. Eventually, this support weakened, which was harmful for the success of Perestroika. Instead of presenting the end of the Cold War as a joint victory over totalitarianism, there has been talk about the United States defeating the USSR. I don't see how it can help to improve relations between Russia and the United States. Seventh and the last, or sixth, this book of joint or maybe parallel memoirs will contain some documentary attachments, including specially made interviews by Mikhail Gorbachev, Eduard Shevardnadze, late Alexander Yakovlev, and some others. I believe I traced the factual situation in our dialogue, and Dick will give a political and ideological assessment to it.
Please go ahead.
Well, as Anatoly has just said, he indeed he has laid out the basic principles that we were trying to follow in the period in which we worked very closely with each other. Let me now just share a few personal experiences with you. As a United States representative to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights in Geneva, I joined my colleagues on March 11, 1985, to rise in tribute to the memory of Konstantin Chernenko, General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party, whose death had just been announced. It happened to be the third commission session in a row in which we paid our last respects to departed General Secretaries of the Soviet Communist Party. It had almost become a habit. It was a result of what my friend Anatoly has referred to as the Soviet Union's rule by a gerontocracy. That evening, at a reception, I asked the head of the Belarusian delegation what he thought of the new leader of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev. His answer was, "I understand he's a nice guy." He then grinned and added, "I read that in the Herald Tribune." A few weeks later, I represented the United States at the human rights meeting in Ottawa of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, CSCE. The Hungarian delegate cornered me early in the session and told me that there was a new spirit hovering over our meeting, the spirit of Mikhail Gorbachev, the man who would bring about drastic change not only in the Soviet Union but worldwide. He urged that the United States should keep this in mind. I did have a bilateral meeting with the Soviet delegation in Ottawa to explore whether there had in fact been a change in outlook, but could not detect it. Later, at an open session, I asked the Soviet delegation what their country had in mind when it agreed 8 years earlier to the so-called third basket, the human rights section of the Helsinki Final Act. The deputy head of the delegation, known to all of us as a KGB general, responded, "We shall comply with it over time." It occurred to me when I heard that, that this sounded like Brown versus Board of Education. 2 months after Gorbachev had been in office, he sent word that he was interested in a summit meeting with President Reagan. Meeting was arranged and took place in November 1985 in Geneva. It was a meeting focused on the very important issue of arms reduction and went rather well. Human rights were touched on very tangentially. The final joint statement of the two delegations contained the following sentence with regard to the understanding reached by Reagan and Gorbachev. They agreed on the importance of resolving humanitarian cases in the spirit of cooperation. A week prior to the Geneva meeting, I had taken office as Assistant Secretary for Human Rights. As I had not been engaged in the Geneva summit, I asked my colleagues at the European Bureau of the State Department what conclusions they had drawn as to the changes that we could expect to take place in the Soviet Union regarding the human rights issue. The responses I received were quite optimistic. Gorbachev and the new Soviet team had made an excellent impression in Geneva, and the sentence in the statement that I've just quoted was viewed as a significant step forward. In the months that followed, I spent a good deal of time monitoring developments in the Soviet Union. I saw no change regarding human rights. Totalitarianism appeared to remain in place. The repression of all forms of dissent, including the resort to abuse of psychiatry, and continued restrictions on the right to leave the country. The Soviet Union's continued failure to live up to the obligations that it had assumed in the Final Act was very much on my mind as we prepared for the next Helsinki follow-up meeting, which was scheduled to start in November 1986 in Vienna. It was in preparation for that meeting that I participated in September in a coordinating session called by the National Security Council's specialist on the Soviet Union. Also participating were my colleagues from the European Bureau and other officials of the U.S. government concerned with issues involving the Soviet Union. Gorbachev had by that time been in office for about a year and a half, and I, for one, had still seen no progress in the Soviet Union's performance in the field of human rights. At the NSC meeting, I made that point and took a hardline approach. I urged strongly that we use the Vienna meeting to call attention to human rights commitments contained in the Helsinki Final Act and the Soviet Union's failure to live up to these commitments. My colleagues from the European Bureau recommended a much softer approach. It was following that meeting that I heard, by the way, Dick Solomon was very much involved in all of these things at the time. It was following that meeting that I heard that one of the Soviet specialists at the European Bureau had said, "The trouble with Schifter is that he's a Menshevik ideologue. He just hates the Bolsheviks." A little over 2 years later, that same official was quoted to me as having said, "The trouble with Schifter is that he's a Menshevik ideologue, and he thinks the Mensheviki have taken over in Moscow." I must confess that I initially resented these comments. However, as I reflected on them in the context of the preparation of these memoirs, I reached the conclusion that my colleague was basically right. Further, in the course of my work on these memoirs, I concluded that there had been another official in the government of the United States who had been influenced by Menshevik thought. He happened to hold a somewhat more important position. He was the President of the United States. If you're interested in how I reached the conclusion that he too, Ronald Reagan, was influenced by Menshevism, I'll be happy to respond to your questions on the subject. But to return to our basic theme, the period from September 1986 to January 1989 is the time period on which Anatoly's and my joint memoirs are focused. It was a truly fascinating period. As a member of the U.S. Army, I had in 1945 been witness to the collapse of Nazi totalitarianism. And then in 1987, and particularly in 1988, I saw the collapse of Soviet totalitarianism. I visited Moscow frequently in those years. From one visit to the next, I saw the fog lift. I found it to be a truly exhilarating time. It is in the context of this comparison that we need to note the fundamental difference between the process that caused the collapse of these two forms of totalitarianism. One system collapsed militarily as the Allied armies moved into Germany. The collapse of Leninist totalitarianism, by contrast, and indeed, as Anatoly pointed out, it was not our victory. The collapse of Leninist totalitarianism came about when the leader of the dictatorship of the proletariat decided that he did not want to be dictator. And with the help of colleagues who had similar sentiments, took the measures necessary to dismantle the totalitarian system. Working for one of Gorbachev's key lieutenants, Edward Shevardnadze, Anatoly played a role in the ending of totalitarian rule. The memoirs explain just what that role was. As for the United States, we can say that we helped. Yet, I, for one, firmly believe that the hero of this story is Mikhail Gorbachev, who made it all happen. Speaking to the United Nations General Assembly in December 1988, he reported on developments in the Soviet Union, and I quote from his speech, "A whole series of new laws have been prepared or are at the completion stage. Many of them come into force as early as 1989, and we trust that they will correspond to the highest standards from the point of view of ensuring the rights of the individual. Soviet democracy is to acquire a firm normative base. This means such acts as the law on freedom of conscience, on glasnost, on public associations and organizations, and on much else. There are now no people in places of imprisonment in the country who have been sentenced for their political or religious convictions." He could have said, "Goodbye, Lenin." The question that might be asked in light of the developments of the last few years is, has Lenin returned? My answer is, I don't think so. He's gone for good. We may very well be back to the court of Tsar Nicholas II. That might be a good topic for another book.
I'd like like to thank both of our speakers for their thoughtful commentary and for sharing with us a piece of really living history. I'm going to take the chair's prerogative to launch the first question, then I'll be opening it up to the floor. And I'd like you to address to what extent you think that your dialogue about human rights might serve as a kind of diplomatic model for international efforts to resolve conflicts elsewhere. And I'm thinking especially in terms of the strengthening of alliances between those on the inside and those on the outside who are looking at human rights concerns in particular as something that they want to find improvement in. And then kind of a second question, what kinds of lessons do you think your experience might offer to international diplomats today?
I think Anatoly has made the point that I think is absolutely correct. We had at the very top Gorbachev and Reagan, and we should not underestimate the very important role played by George Shultz on the United States side and by Edward Shevardnadze on the other. At each level, there really was cooperation and trust that really truly developed among these four people. Under these circumstances, the task for us was, as they say, the devil is in the details. It really was necessary to translate the overall concept here that both our foreign ministers and our presidents had into detailed action. And it is in that context that the point that Anatoly made is very important. And in the foreign ministry, they very often did not know what was going on elsewhere. And in particular, let's put it most bluntly, what it was that's being done above all by the KGB. And problem was that under these circumstances, you had segments in Soviet society that were not cooperating with the top leadership of the government. And it was necessary under these circumstances for people at the lower echelons to be alerted to what other people were failing to do and making sure that they get themselves organized. And one of the things that I found was that, first of all, there was a foreign ministry that began to take a totally different view of things. And that is, that really helped realize the Gorbachev reforms. I also want to tell you that at a certain time, there were some people in the Central Committee of the Communist Party who had gotten the word from the top and also from the foreign ministry on how to deal with it. And keep in mind, Shevardnadze was a member of the Politburo, so there were people then on the staff of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. There were bad guys, and there were some good guys. And it was a matter of really working with the good guys. Gorbachev, I think, was the perfect example of that. So the answer to your questions, I see it, is that what you need in the first instance is a commitment at the very top, that you want things changed. That is absolutely essential. If you don't have that, nothing's going to happen. But at the lower level, you then need people who really can begin to work with each other, and this is what we were able to do, to carry out in detail the general principles that have been agreed to at the top.
Anatoly, do you care to add anything?
I repeat this time seriously that we did set up a good dialogue with Dick. And I agree completely with him that the main thing is to work inside a team which knows what it wants, and you may rely on people like my immediate boss Shevardnadze, and then Gorbachev on the straight line, that you don't let you down. And as for the proofs of this fact that we made a good dialogue is that not before us, not after us, this dialogue existed. This is an interesting detail. If it didn't exist before, it's more and less understandable. But why it didn't prolong after? It's a question of further, so to say, investigation. And maybe, to my knowledge, only now that there are some attempts to talk between people who are busy with human rights in Russia and in the United States. so the first thing, certainly, it's you have to know what do you want and to work with people who share your views. And it's half job, so to say, because you need, as Dick oftenly says, to find out the details, and the devil is strong in the details, yeah? And here, to work well, I believe we may repeat, as I said in my book, is my part of the book, we repeat the French Revolution slogan, Liberté, égalité, fraternité. You must be free to talk freely with each other. You have to do it from the positions of equality. And then you have to find out some chemistry between you to work on that. And I believe that the merit was, first of all, of Dick. Because when we were beginning, I was rather orthodox communist, so to say. And Dick mentioned that when he asked to have some characteristic from the American embassy in Moscow, who is Adamyshyn, they replied, he is tough but civilized. So to do...
You remain the same.
So you just need to be tough but civilized.
Maybe I have one more. Let me actually give you a very concrete illustration that will ultimately be in the book as to how things worked out. We had a summit in Moscow in the summer of July, I think it was, of 88. And George Shultz describes this in his memoirs, how he and Shevardnadze by that time had been really very close with each other. Reagan and Gorbachev had also at that particular point become very, very friendly with each other. And we had the CSCE meeting in Vienna still going on, and the idea was to bring the CSCE meeting to a conclusion and then follow it up with what turned out to be very important in the matter of arms reduction, that is to enter into an agreement among the European countries and the United States and Canada on the reduction of conventional forces in Europe, the CFE agreement. It turned out to be a very, very important issue. So there were these developments in which very important decisions were made by the two presidents, but above all, I want to say, by George Shultz and Shevardnadze. And George Shultz in particular was increasingly interested to complete this work on his watch, which would end on January 19th, 1989. So we were working along in putting all the pieces together. In the middle of November, I was out on doing some things. Matter of fact, come to think of it, it was early in November, and I had voted that morning, and came to the office and found a cable that with instructions to the embassy in Moscow to deliver a message to the Soviet Foreign Ministry. I read that cable, and I then called the Executive Secretary of the State Department and said, I'm not clearing on this cable. It doesn't represent the views of the Secretary of State. So the answer I got was, I'm terribly sorry, it has already gone out. The Secretary has signed off on it. So I said, I'm absolutely certain the Secretary didn't have a chance to really read this carefully. This is a message to the Soviets that we are not going to finish things at the Vienna meeting. So he said, well, gee, the meeting has, cable has gone out. So I said, well, give me a chance to talk to the Secretary and review this question with him. So I went to see, I think it was day after or 2 days after, I had a chance to meet with Secretary Schultz, and I brought the cable in. I had underlined all the phrases that I thought did not reflect his point of view, and I showed it to him. He read it, and then he became just absolutely silent. And I had been told that when George Schultz is very silent, he's very angry. And he was obviously very angry that that had been put over on him. So
not many people have this habit.
So I said to him, it so happens I'm going to be in Moscow next Monday. If you would like to send new instructions, I'll be able to do that. So he said, good idea. He called somebody in, and we started talking, and we formulated, going back and forth, what basic principles I should lay out, and making it clear that if these are the conditions that are going to be fulfilled by the Soviets, we are ready to agree to closing of the Vienna meeting and going forward with the CFE talks. When he escorted me, I still remember he escorted me to through his, so the meeting was in the inner office, he escorted me through the outer office, and then when we got to the door, he said, you can tell them I have problems with my bureaucracy too. So at any rate, I walked back to my office. I thought, number one, that I thought we had succeeded here. And then I realized this was Thursday. I was not going to be in Moscow until the following Monday. Things might gel in Moscow on the basis of that cable that would have been delivered. And there was this, I really began to worry about that things might just go sour just because of this delay in time between my arrival there and the delivery of the cable. So I was trying to figure out, what do I do about this? Now, in view of the fact that the cable had been drafted in the European Bureau, I came to the conclusion, if I talk to them, God knows what they're going to do with this now. I couldn't do that. I guess this is all sort of ancient history, so I can speak freely about these things. So then I thought, well, maybe I should get in touch with Jack Matlock, our ambassador in Moscow. But I didn't know where he stood. It turned out, when he wrote his memoirs, that he and I saw things exactly the same way, but I didn't know that. So whom do I, what do I do? I called Sergei Chetverikov, who was at that time the deputy chief of mission at the Soviet embassy here. And I told him, I said, look, I have instructions from the secretary to deliver to your government, I'll be in Moscow next Monday, deliver secretary's message. Just hold everything until then. So following Monday, I get to Moscow and immediately told by Anatoly that a meeting had been set up for me with the first deputy, principal first deputy, whatever it is called, the number two man. His name was Kolyov. The meeting had been set up for me to discuss my message. And that afternoon I met with Kolyov and presented, well, first of all, I started out by, he said, I understand you have a message from Secretary Schultz. I said, yes. So then he asked me, when did you talk to him? I said, last Thursday. And then there was an exchange in Russian between him and one of the other officials sitting there, and our DCM in Moscow was sitting next to me, spoke Russian and interpreted for me, and said he was asking when was that cable delivered. And the answer was Wednesday. So in other words, I was trumping the cable, it was clear. And we spent 3 hours together. I admit it was translation too, but we spent 3 hours working on all the details of this matter. And then at the end he said, all right, he's going to see the minister now, Shevardnadze. Next morning I was someplace else in Moscow. I get a call to come back to the foreign ministry, and everything that we were asking for, the answer was yes. There was one exception, as a matter of fact, and that is when we had asked for a clear statement that the Soviet Union was going to adhere to the human rights principles of the Helsinki Final Act. What I was told was, look, we can't make this statement in Vienna at the CSCE meeting, and we can't make it bilaterally to you, but don't worry, we'll do it. And that then was the Gorbachev statement I read before at the UN. So that's how we closed it, and on January 17th, we were in Vienna. We ended the Vienna meeting with George Shultz leading the U.S. delegation at that point. So it was done, and 3 weeks later, the negotiations on the reduction of conventional forces in Europe started and succeeded. At any rate, that tells you sort of about the interaction between what you do at the lower level and what they have to decide at the top. But the point is, I was just carrying out George Shultz's instructions. And in the meantime, of course, one of the things with Anatoly, I didn't add that, he had gotten hold of me a few months earlier in Milan, and we were walking along the streets of Milan negotiating with each other, and he was telling me what the Soviet Union was looking for in this particular context and the importance of what the Soviet Union was looking for. And again, there was this very informal way. He had his instructions, and here we were walking along in Milan in the street talking to each other and working this out.
And I was very thankful for you for a chance to send something important contrary to what U.S. Embassy in Moscow was reporting. So that really worked well.
Sergei, you have to send first of all me, because when we got your cable in Moscow, everybody was asking, can we trust Shifter? Can we trust it very recall? We have an official cable and there is a sort of conspiracy on something. Like it wasn't easy to convince people that this is the right track, so to say, and not the official one.
We have a number of other people who have been engaged in some piece of this story. I don't know, Dick, if you have anything you want to add to this particular discussion.
Well, I can make one more recent quote from George Shultz, who has several times said that, in his view, Dick Shifter really is a hero of all of the things that have transpired in terms of the evolution of human rights in the Soviet Union, Russia. And let me just say, I'm really pleased that Dick and Anatoly now are going to tell their story, because it's an exceptionally important piece of history. And it's important not only for the human dimensions of it and understanding the bureaucratics and the politics, which we've gotten a good taste of, but they are wrestling with one of the most tricky issues that anyone in diplomacy has to confront. And that is how one tries to promote political change in other countries. And I worked for Henry Kissinger back in the early 70s. Kissinger wouldn't touch human rights issues. He felt it was interference in the internal affairs of other countries. But more that it wasn't, he understood the tension between the subversive effect of pushing for human rights change and the effort to work on what he would say are hard power issues with countries where you share common security interests. And unlike Kissinger, today you have an administration that is operating in a very complex way and a confusing way where, just to take a simple example, they desperately need the cooperation of Egypt in dealing with a lot of the problems in the Middle East. And at the same time, they're pressing the Egyptians on human rights issues. To what effect? To destabilize the country. Mubarak is deathly afraid of the emergence of the Muslim Brotherhood element destabilizing his country. You could say the same thing with the Saudis. Countries where we have serious interests of a sort of power security character, but at the same time, this administration is pressing these governments to do destabilizing moves in the area of human rights and democratization. Now, one reason, again, I, having lived through some of these periods of seeing these tensions, when I first came to the Institute, we started a project to try to evaluate how we implement human rights. And Debbie Leon Fenton did a very interesting book over several years that pulled together those experiences. The basic fact is our Congress presses the State Department to push for human rights. They'll see dissidents being suppressed or an event like Tiananmen Square, the violence used against them at peaceful demonstrators, and the Congress will, and I don't want to make this sound too cynical, but they will press for counterproductive actions to make sure that their constituencies at home understand that their heart is in the right place, but they're pressing for sanctions of various sorts that have almost no effect on changing the way that human rights are managed in this or that country. And Nancy Pelosi and I, when I was in the State Department, had some lively exchanges on that issue. She wanted all sorts of economic and other sanctions put on the Chinese for Tiananmen. And I would say, yes, but if you want to promote social change in China, one of the best ways to do it is encourage economic reform, and that will set in motion long-term social change. But she didn't want long-term social change. She wanted to demonstrate that we were being tough on the Chinese. So Debbie did some very interesting studies that are now published in one of our books on on that issue. The key point that I think comes out of the study that Dick and Anatoly have done is the critical importance of leadership. That you're pushing against the closed door if you have a leadership that is determined to resist those destabilizing moves. And what is so dramatic about the story you tell is how a leadership in a Leninist country concluded that it wasn't working anymore. And that was one of the messages that Reagan and Shultz conveyed over and over again to the Soviet leadership, particularly Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, and made them feel that we would work with them in a relatively non-threatening way, that we were pursuing parallel tracks. Gorbachev wanted change in the Soviet Union because he understood that the system wasn't working. And so that, plus the personal relationships that you've described, and the interpersonal trust was a critical element of it, gave two leaderships that instead of being confrontational in this issue came to work in parallel. And that's a very powerful story, and again, I think you're making a real contribution by documenting what you've done.
Thank you. I had a question over here.
Just a clarification and then a question. Anatoly, you made the point that not everything in your dialogue was in, to satisfy U.S. concerns and demands. And you said, citing the problem, what I heard was Nazi, but I didn't hear the rest of it. So if you could clarify that point. And then my general question was, at what point did the two of you come to realize how symbiotic this relationship, how helpful, mutually helpful this relationship could be? And were Shultz and Shevardnadze's relations coming along about the same time or behind yours or as a result of your particular on-the-ground experiences?
Could I first just ask you to identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Marjorie Sonnenfeld.
Thank you.
It's to me?
Well, yes, particularly the clarification.
Nazi criminals. They were in the United States, but they were not in the Soviet Union. So this was one-way topic. Probably one of very rare topics which was in Soviet Union benefit. But for us, it wasn't important to make really balance. We concede in Jewish migration, and you then concede in some other things. I believe that the most important thing for me when I was dealing with this problem was that I, for many years, saw that these things are absurd, that these things are bad, that we should to correct them. But the only situations when you may correct them, it was to diminish the damage, but not to make something really productive. Maybe I follow Dick's example and tell you very short story about my heroic It's 1982 or 3, I don't remember now, but it's Madrid meeting on the Pan-European Conference. And the situation is really desperate because there was Korean liner shot by the Soviet Union. There was a very high tension in relations between Gromyko and Shultz and between Reagan and Andropov as well. So the situation was very bad. And the destiny of this Madrid meeting was just on the brink. And since I was dealing with these problems, I see that my minister is ready to sacrifice Madrid meeting. I don't know for what reasons. Probably to show that he is tough, that he is the Minister of Foreign Affairs is by definition a duff. And he wouldn't be considered a duff, yeah? So he just wanted to show off his toughness. So it is my very clear impression that he is ready, together with some tough people on the American side, to bury the Madrid meeting and with it the pan-European process as well. And I tried to explain, I tried to convince him, and nothing works. Then what I'm doing? I am calling the assistant of General Secretary Andropov, saying, Blatov, Anatoly Ivanovich, the situation is dead. You even didn't get the cables from Madrid because Gromyko didn't pass it over. And you don't know that the situation is very difficult and we may lose Madrid meeting. Then Blatov talks to Andropov, and for, again, not very clear reasons for me, Andropov were less interested not to dropping off Madrid meeting than Gromyko. So he pushed Gromyko, and his position changed 180 degrees immediately. And my only praying was that my telephone wasn't on. Because certainly this emploi would be very, very difficult with my minister. Yeah, but there were some methods of working, Machiavellist working, because I knew that Blatov had the same views as me. Yeah. For the town, for some cooperation, and so on. While we tried together to convince the chief, this time Andropov, to make this choice.
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Collins. I'm a freelance writer with a background in CBS, ABC, CNN, and VOA. I have two questions for Anatoly Leonidovich. Anatoly, you said that devil is in the details. I'm curious as to how you got that number of 53 million political prisoners at one time or another. Are you referring to from 1917 to the end, or what period of time are you talking about?
No. It's really a figure that should be clarified. Maybe in speaking it's difficult to understand. Between 20s, years 20s, and 50s, in the Soviet Union were issued 52 million of political sentences.
Political what?
Sentences.
This was the terrible time, so to say. And in 1988, as Dick and me mentioned, Gorbachev, speaking at the United Nations, said that there was no more people in Russia incarcerated for their political views or religious convictions.
My second question is, Anatoly Leonidovich, you described yourself as once having been an orthodox communist, one could say a Bolshevik. What are you now, a Menshevik?
I'm sorry.
What if you now, a Menshevik?
You know, the evolution, the evolution is a complicated thing to explain in two words. I came to this world with the sensation that I live in the best country of the world. That the socialism is the best possible arrangement of the humankind, that we know all the laws of history, and we show the way to all the humanity, and this is our mission. And a lot of things were unknown to us, to this generation. But you can't live with your eyes openly shut. From time to time, you see what is happening, and if you a person who can see the things and who has his idea of what his country has to be, then you begin to rethink it. Maybe it's too strong to say that I was Orthodox communist, because the story with the Communist Party, at least at my middle age, was that honest people didn't want to join the party. It was only for those who wanted to make career. And the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sergei, knows it. It was impossible to work if you are not a member of the Communist Party. And still, I worked 6 years in the ministry without applying for the communist membership.
No, I didn't know that.
And only when it was really pushing, well, but it's impossible. So what are you doing here? And by the way, when in 1991 everybody was tearing off their communist
membership.
I consulted. I consulted just not to do what everybody was doing. So we were prepared with Dick. We were both Mensheviks, so to say. Probably it's like Plekhanov, or I don't know who else was Reagan.
Richard, who is your favorite Menshevik?
Actually, believe it or not, my mother.
But to be more precise, it's more social democracy. What is the Mensheviks are social democrats.
Social democrats, yeah.
Yeah?
My name is Murad Ekbal, University of Baltimore Center for International and Comparative Law, and I have a question addressed to both of our speakers. To begin with, I wanted to thank them for having taken the time to put their experiences in the form that is preserved and that is going to be useful for future generations. My specific question really projects rather than looking back at the history that you've covered. Because it seems to me that much of the success of this humanitarian and human rights dialogue in the context of the United States and the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, relied in there being a meeting of the minds, at least between our two speakers, and that really pressed on down further, above and beyond what in the higher echelons of our governments there may have been a meeting of the minds. My focus is on the region that stretches from Syria through Iraq to Iran, in which both Russia as well as the United States have very significant strategic and foreign policy interests. And the question I have is whether you think if a similar dialogue were to be set in motion nowadays involving that region with similar goals, whether that might not be a better way to proceed than in the manner we've been proceeding at least for the last 6 to 8 years.
Dick, you're older than me.
I believe the situation is totally different, and I believe that we really are not in a situation of conflict in that region between the Russian Federation and the United States. I happen to think, and I've discussed this with Anatoly, that the problem is that the leadership of the Russian Federation does not understand what is in their own best interest. And what is in their own best interest is to associate themselves with the West. And their failure to do that may someday really haunt them. It may very well be that this takes us actually back to sort of the opposite of what Kissinger was thinking, and that is that the present leadership of the Soviet Union is not thinking in broad geopolitical terms, but largely in terms of personal power. And when the United States criticizes the internal operations of the present Russian system that then dictates to them how they should handle themselves geopolitically. When, as I say, I think they're making very serious long-range mistakes for the Russian Federation.
I would add small points. First point, that my government doesn't pay me for 8 years, so I'm not responsible for its policy. Second point, I believe that it is very important to have such kind of dialogue between Russia and the United States. And I just don't have information whether this dialogue is having place or not. But I believe that it is extremely important, or at least on Iran, there is such a dialogue, there is such a cooperation between several countries. With Iraq, I believe it's a bit difficult, because if I understand correctly, now in Moscow, the conception is that I don't say this is a good conception. I just try to explain what is, to my view, this conception. We are not with anybody in this world. We are a cat who works for himself. Yeah. So, in this, as sometimes say, saint struggle, we don't participate on neither side. And so we could be on a position of mediation, of helping others to find solutions, but we don't on the side of the United States, as well as we are not on the side of Muslim, so to say, forces. This is the positions of, as we sometimes say in Russian, to pass inside the raindrops. I don't know whether it will work, but for the time being, as I see it, this is the position.
Okay. Okay, we have several questions, so I think we'll take a group of them, and Gerald and Phoebe and Al-Bakir are next on my list. Are there any others who want to be added at this point? Okay, one, two. Okay, why don't we take these three first, then we'll get you to.
My question is for Ambassador Anatoly. I'm just curious to know, how is the Russian state dealing with the concerns of victims of these past human rights abuses? Is the issue discussed? Has there been any effort to record the violations? Have there been claims for reparations? How is the Russian state dealing with living victims of those past human rights abuses?
There are some kind of payments for ex-political prisoners. Yeah, you mean that? The victims of political repression and so on. But to my mind, they are very, 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 very small. So this is not the problem inside my country now.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on that interesting question that was asked about the application of your process to the Soviet Union, which was successful. That is to say, the focusing on human rights and getting some change and some result of it on the Middle East, leaving aside the Iraq situation, now would say Egypt or the Gulf or many of these countries. What do you think the lessons are of your experience for the Middle East? As I understood it, this process was successful. That is to say, pushing on the human rights lever and getting change inside the Soviet Union, partly, at least because you said, Anatoly, it really was generated inside the Soviet Union. There were people like yourself who wanted this, and then we had Gorbachev. And what I understood from you both was that it depends on high-level leadership at the top. And then, but I'm still impressed by the fact that there was a hard core of people inside the Soviet Union who supported that, maybe not a majority, but a hard core. Are there any lessons in that process for us in the Middle East as we try to get some kind of reform? Or do you see similar situations? Or what lessons can we draw from your experience for the Middle East?
That's it.
Should we take one more?
Well, my questions to Ambassador Anatoly. The two questions. One is just out of curiosity. And it is based on what you said about that you didn't know about so many things in the USSR at that moment, especially about human rights violations. I wonder whether you and the officials at that time read George Orwell's books, 1984 and Animal Farm.
Not all the officials.
And if so, what was the reaction to them? This is the first question. The second question, why did Gorbachev, after doing such good things, fail in the elections? And what is his current situation? Whether he would have any future career in politics within Russia?
What we are doing.
You want to start? See, we have
First, maybe. I believe that the main lesson that would be drawn from our experience is that you have to be interested in this cooperation. And we were interested in the cooperation, both the Soviet Union, for reasons of their own, and the United States for reasons of their own. If there is no mutual reason, a mutual interest to cooperate, then you can't do absolutely anything. In this particular case with the Middle East, I believe that we are not in equal position. The Americans has a very strong position in the Middle East, and we don't have them, or we have wrong position in the Middle East. So it's difficult to have an equalitarian dialogue in these conditions. And I believe, I may say it frankly to you, that here a lot depends on the American side. If the American side manifests, displays its readiness to talk with Russians and to be interested in their opinions, to have some kind of practical results of this cooperation, because I think that we know a lot about Iraq. And we know a lot about many things that are happening in the Middle East. Then it could be done. Here the ball is on the American side. I don't know whether Americans are interested in such a dialogue. About knowing and not knowing, you know, we lived in a country which was practically unknown to everybody. I couldn't name a single person in the Soviet Union who did know everything, really. First of all, because the system was of this construction, which is very, very steep. And secondly, because there was a craziness of secrecy. You had in every department a special person whose duty was only to not to permit or to look after the people. So even Andropov, when he came to the post number one in the Soviet Union, General Secretary, after being the KGB chairman. He once exclaimed, we have still to find out what society we have constructed, we have built in our country. When Gorbachev and Shevardnadze and other people came to power, they didn't know their country. They really didn't know what the, for example, military-industrial complex is. And nobody knew it. Nobody knew how much it was splendid and how difficult it was to take in reins all this activity. And Gorbachev, he made a lot of errors on its beginning before he just didn't realize the situation in which country is. And now you asked why he failed. I believe that the answer is very short. Bolshevik won. He was Menshevik and is Menshevik, and he is the head of the Social Democratic Party now. I believe that now he understands much more than he did before. And still, he is not, to my mind, is fully acquainted with the reality. He may say, for example, I was really struck that during my time of Glasnost, there was less liberty of mass media than now, which is absolutely incorrect, absolutely incorrect. So the main tragedy of Russia, then, this is the Tsar who can do the things. If the Tsar is against reforms, you can't do any reform. The system is Tsarist one. And for last 200 or 300 years, I believe we have 2 or 3 Tsars who were reforming mind. This is the situation. I mean Alexander II, and then half Khrushchev, who did want to reform the country, and Gorbachev. And in this country, you make democracy, you make freedom, you make reforms only from the top for the time being. And it remains, unfortunately, now as well. This is the matrix which Russia follows, beginning, I believe, from the Tatar-Mongol invasion.
We're just about out of time, but we've got 2 remaining questions, so I'll ask you to
Quick. I'm Jonathan Slevin with the Washington Times. As I mentioned, they don't let me write anything there, so on the business side. My question is simply this. How was Gorbachev able to survive during the period of reform? You know, with KGB power, military power, you know, just simply, how was he able to move anything forward and actually survive politically, if not actually?
It's a very good question. I believe he several times was on the brink, Gorbachev, as well, and sometimes physically on the brink, like this famous Foros situation when the Putsch people took him prisoner in Crimean resort. The phenomenon Gorbachev, and Dick always tells me, Tolya, study phenomenon Gorbachev. It's very important, really, phenomenon. Because Gorbachev could have lived quietly as a Tsar for a period longer than Brezhnev, for many years. It's really a rare situation, not only for Russia, but for many other countries, when a leader chooses the country interest and not his own. And so he could put in motion this movement because the country was on the brink as well. So there was a lot of people who wanted to change, to reform the things. And even Gorbachev has been elected because of these moods of the people. Dick mentioned that he came for funeral of Chernenko. There were three secretary generals who died in two or 3 years. And there was a joke in Moscow that I have a membership in the Cologne Hall where the funeral, the state funerals were. And the people were writing, elect Gorbachev. We are fed up with boring the general secretaries. Really. So this movement certainly helped Gorbachev to survive. And then the respect that the general secretary of the party, number one, in the party, in the country, is very high, and they defended him too, with all the attacks and so on. And probably the most important one thing is that he created the climate where it would be impossible to make some, so to say, tough movements. So it was really a very, very exciting period in the Russian history, this heroic attempt to change the country, which was extremely difficult to change, and which in many cases didn't want to be changed. This is the situation, because the people is as it is, and the political education, the political culture is extremely low, and it's extremely low because it was constantly kept on this low level. So there was a Marx expression about the Paris revolutionaries, yeah, which were storming the heaven, the skies. Yeah, so Gorbachev and his people, they were storming the heavens. And usually these people didn't finish well, those who stormed the heavens.
John, we'll give you the last question.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both for an excellent presentation. You've been very persuasive about the important role of leadership in terms of making these negotiations turn out successfully and of having good, solid relations between the negotiators on either side. But, of course, negotiations, as you well know, are a very complex thing. There's probably a lot of factors that make for success or failure across the board on negotiations. And clearly one, at least in our experience around this table over the years, has also been the question of the issues that are on the table to be negotiated. And mediators talk a lot about finding the right issues, issues that are, if they are to be negotiated, will be meaningful, that the parties are able to deliver on, or one party or another able to deliver on in a fashion that doesn't, you know, break it apart, and so forth and so on. So what I would be very curious to hear about is how is it that you settled on this bundle of three or four core issues that were most important for the negotiations, when presumably there could have been any number of other human rights issues that might have been brought to the table at that time. Were these just the sort of most serious ones, or was there some other thought in terms of how to identify the right issues for negotiation at this time and in this process?
I begin to answer and then pass the word to Dick. Okay. The merit is of the Assistant Secretary of State, because he didn't push us too far. He have been choosing the topics which were evident, so to say, for us as well. And it wasn't the appeal, introduce democracy, or something like that, or you are retreating for democracy. It was very, very, so to say, practical and selective and mild approach. It helped very much, really. Because if Dick says that psychiatry, the abuse of psychiatry, is a bad thing, who can object? Who can argue? Yeah? If Dick says that you have people who are not permitted to leave for secrecy reasons after 30 years having quitted the secrecy job. Certainly it's a thing that everybody from our side, on our side, would be ready to examine. So this was very important, to choose right topics and right place.
You could add?
Well, what I can say is that throughout this period that I was Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, the way I looked at my responsibilities was in a situation in which there was a real distinct immediate possibility of changing to democracy, I would work on that. For example, in the case of Chile, to the best of my recollection, I really worked out all the various requirements in quite a bit of detail for the 1988 referendum in terms of the ambassador was very happy to get this because what the Chilean government and Pinochet was hoping for was that they were going to run a referendum that would be, and the result, which they thought they would win, would be blessed by the United States. So the question was, under what circumstances would you want to get it blessed? Would you bless it? So I said, well, what you have to do is make sure that you have registration places open on weekends and evenings so that people who work will have a chance to register to vote. And then I laid out some rules for as far as the media were concerned, and then both print media and then electronic media. In the case of the Soviet Union, walking in and saying, okay, you junk it all and start from scratch, would have gotten us nowhere. And the way I looked at it at the time was, if you just look at it from a purely human point of view, look at the people that are now suffering seriously. That is where you start. The point that I'm saying I used to offer was that we would like to create a situation where the members of the Politburo would turn to the head of the KGB and would say, comrade, we know all of this business about psychiatry is just capitalist propaganda, but whatever you do, stop it. That's what I used to say. It happened. I don't know whether it was the Politburo, but somebody told them to stop it, and they stopped it. And then, indeed, let me just give you this vivid description, if I can. Again, one of the things that we arranged, and Anatoly was involved in this, was, still remember, in November 1987, we had a session with Shevardnadze. It was Undersecretary Whitehead and I and Shevardnadze and interpreters. That was it. And we were talking about Mr. Whitehead was laying down, John Whitehead was laying down all kinds of cases of people who were in prison for political reasons, and Shevardnadze said, I want you to know I'm the foreign minister. What can I do about this? These are people who are convicted under the laws of the Soviet Union, who are in prisons run by the Ministry of Interior, convicted under the courts of the Justice Ministry. This is not the foreign minister's job to do anything about this. So I still remember what I said was, Mr. Minister, the fact of the matter is that these people were convicted under laws that are in conflict with the obligations you undertook under the Helsinki Final Act. And then I said, Article 70, Article 190-1, Article 142, Article 227, these anyone convicted under these articles,
one had to know all these articles,
should be released from prison, and these articles ought to be repealed. And in view of the fact that your ministry, the foreign ministry, negotiated this agreement under which Brezhnev then signed the Helsinki Final Act, that is your responsibility. And I still remember this being translated to Shevardnadze, and he had very big eyes, and I looked at him, and I just thought and saw a recognition in his eyes. And then 6 weeks later, I had lunch with Anatoly Adomishin, and he said, "We have decided to bring ourselves into compliance with our international obligations." So, but you see, the idea was to try to focus on something very concrete rather than generalities, even when it comes to this matter of people who weren't being released, who were not given exit permits. I remember I started with whoever was out of classified work for the longest period. And I remember at the very beginning of my list, the very top of my list, was a woman. I still remember her name was Irina Varshavskaya. And she had been working for the NKVD, the predecessor of the KGB, and had quit in 1947. And here we were 40 years later, and she was still not allowed to leave the country because she had worked back then for the NKVD. So that she was at the top of the list. Shall I also tell how I got her out? What happened was, let me tell you, this is really very funny. What happened was that I looked at the New York Times one day, and there it said the new head of the KGB had been appointed, and his name was Kirilchikov. And I looked at the picture of the man, and I thought of the fact that I knew somebody by that name who looked somewhat like that picture, but was much younger. So the next time I was in Moscow, I asked, we had a meeting with all foreign ministry officials, and I said, is Sergei Khrushchev, whom I knew, related to your new head of KGB? And the answer that I got was, yes, he's his son. So I said, is there any chance of my talking to him? And I was told, well, he's in the building somewhere around here. So I said, you know, we really would like to talk to him. So they brought him around, and we shook hands, and we had met in Paris at UNESCO a few years earlier, and had gotten acquainted at that point. So we just talked about Paris, talked about other things, and then I said, Sergei, I really have a matter that I hope you will be willing to take up with your father. So he said, I have nothing to do with that organization. I have nothing to do with that. So I said, look, I'm not saying you have anything to do with that organization. My suspicion was, quite frankly, he did. That's beside the point. I said, but, you know, when I just would like you to do this as a son talking to his father. When my son has something to talk to me about, I'll listen. So here is the case. So I said, there is this woman who stopped working for the NKVD 40 years ago, and she still cannot join her son in Denmark because of what happened 40 years ago. I mean, her job 40 years ago. As a matter of fact, I was told she had a nervous breakdown, by the way, back then. So he said, well, I can't do anything about it. Then he walked off, and about 5 minutes later, he came back with somebody else from the foreign ministry, Mr. Obuchov.
So
he said, tell it to him. So I gave my spiel again to him. 3 weeks later, she was out of the Soviet Union. So, you know, when you...
But
what is necessary is to really get involved in details. Yeah, that's what's necessary here. And to do it in a way, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you think about it, who was hurt by the fact that this woman was being released, allowed to go to see her, to live with her son in Denmark.
But from what you're saying, Richard, it turns out that it was Anatoly who told KGB to do this.
Well, I think these are wonderful stories to end on, and I've been privileged to read the manuscript, and it's full of all sorts of additional anecdotes, so I would commend it to you when it finally reaches press. We have been delighted to share some time with Richard Shifter and Anatoly Adamishin and to learn from their experiences and also to hear from all of you and your experiences. And we're getting to the end of our senior fellow season. We have, I think, three remaining senior fellow project reports. There is a schedule outside. I would invite you to pick one up, and we look forward to seeing you at the next one. Thank you again.
Just a moment. If we write a good book with Dick, a big merit goes to our wives. And if I may reveal a small secret, Shifters 2 days ago celebrated their 58th anniversary of wedding.